Money Radio. Thank you for joining us. It is a pleasure to welcome David S. Rose. He is CEO of Gust, Gust.com, and founder of New York Angels. He has been described by Forbes as New York's archangel, by Business Week as a world-conquering entrepreneur, and by Crane's New York Business as the father of angel investing in New York. He is also the author of a new book, Angel Investing, The Gust Guide to Making Money and Having Fun Investing in Startups. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure being here.
I think probably the first thing we need to do is clearly identify exactly what is angel investing and how does it differ from some of the other forms of investing that we may have heard of.
Well, that's a very good question. People often use it without spaces, like angels and venture capitalists, or VCs and angels, and they're not quite sure what the difference is. And there's a very, very big difference. The thing that angels are often looked at as closest to are venture capital funds that invest in hot, growing companies. But the difference is that a venture capital fund is a professional fund. It's a professional investment manager raises a pot of money from institutions and goes and invests that in high growth companies, whereas angel investors, the subject of our conversation, are individual people like you and me who invest out of their own pockets, their own money, into startup companies very, very early in the life of the company to give it that first capital that then launches them on their way to eventually later on getting venture capital and getting private equity and going public.
And how did you get involved in becoming an angel investor?
Well, like many angel investors, I'm actually a serial entrepreneur. I've started several companies in my past, and I'm a third-generation entrepreneur. But what makes me particularly interesting, I think, is I am the only third-generation angel investor that I know about. My late great-uncle, who was born in the 19th century, was actually an angel investor, although he was an angel investor before the term was of angel investing was applied to what he was doing. He was the original David Rose, after whom I was named, and actually dedicated the book. And this is a guy who in his 70s began looking at how he could give back to the world and help, you know, take the money that he had earned as an entrepreneur and help to catalyze new technology. So he was the angel investor behind the portable kidney dialysis unit, vascular stapling, hyperbaric operating chambers, desalination projects in the Middle East. Extraordinary guy. And when he was doing this stuff and he was putting seed capital behind these ideas and these entrepreneurs and these inventors and scientists, people thought that he was absolutely nuts because there was certainly no coverage or track record about this thing, this early stage investing. In the years since then, with the explosion of technology and the internet, it's become much more mainstream. So now you have shows like Shark Tank on television and Silicon Valley, and everybody hears about Zuckerberg and Jobs and Gates and so on and so forth. And all these major companies got their initial funding after the cash coming out of the entrepreneur's pocket. And after, in many cases, friends and family putting funds in, they get the next cash from angel investors. And so it's become a big industry to the tune of over $25 billion annually in the U.S. is invested in these startup companies by angels.
In the book, you describe your uncle as his description of himself as an innovation catalyst. Is that still a fair assessment of what angel investors are doing?
To an extent. In his honor, he was pretty extraordinary. He was a world traveler. He'd travel around the world. He'd see something, an idea, very interesting in Sweden or in the Middle East, and he would then come back and find a developer, entrepreneur here and put together the idea and the entrepreneur and the funding to make it work. Angels still can be very active in that sense and very catalyzing, but today primarily there are so many resources and so much communication, global bringing of everything together, that angels these days primarily provide the capital, the early stage seed capital, and then advice and mentorship of companies.
You also say in the book that making money is no longer about sitting around and reading stock list. Why and what are the numbers that one might compare to stock investing as opposed to angel investing?
Well, you know, these days with more and more options, it used to be that if you wanted to invest your nest egg, you would put it in the bank and then you'd put it in the stock market and public equities, and then maybe you'd begin to put some into government bonds or commercial bonds. And then as more and more vehicles became available, whether you're talking about hedge funds or private equity, it began to expand. And then the whole world of alternative assets as part of a portfolio, real estate, oil and gas, you know, venture capital, other kinds of things began to come into play as parts of a full portfolio. But historically, angel investing directly into these startup privately held companies was something that was either unavailable or if it was available because you could actually find these startup companies, there was no discipline around it. And that has changed dramatically because now the cost of starting a new company has dropped like a rock. When I started my first company back in the early 1990s, it took $20 million of venture capital for us to get to the shipment of our internet product. My second company only took $2 million in venture capital. Then when I started angel investing, the first company in which I angel invested only took $200,000 to get to its internet product ship. And that's a two-order of magnitude difference. We invested at New York Angels, the group here in New York that I founded a number of years ago, in a company that was doing an online marketplace for video stock footage, footage that could be used by independent film producers and you know, TV clips and film clips. When they came to us, they had a full management team. They had managed to develop the site through one of the original founding partners. They were generating revenue, and the total cash that they had invested at that point was $20,000. So another whole order of magnitude less. So we then, our members of New York Angels, our angel investment group here, put in $500,000, $500,000 into that company, which let them hire more staff and build a larger site and do some marketing. And that was about 7 years ago, and that was the last cash they ever took in from outside. They used that cash very efficiently and grew to be very, very big. And today they're the world's largest online video stock footage marketplace.
What kind of returns should an angel investor look for, and what is the basic point at which they should say, not enough, or that's an overpromise? It looks like too much.
Well, there are actually two answers to that question. There is the specific individual answer for what should I look for in a company in which I invest, and then there is the answer in what should I look for in a return for my whole portfolio. And what's fascinating about angel investing and different from any other kind of traditional public equity investing is that those numbers are wildly different. The reason is that startup companies, startup investing is very, very risky. And like it or not, a majority of all the companies in which we invest fail. And I don't mean they don't return a whole lot of money or they return a little bit of money. No, they return no money, zero. So if you were going into a investing strategy where you know upfront that half of your investments are going to fail, you have to do a very different analysis than you would do in a public stock portfolio where you certainly don't assume that anybody is going to fail. The only question is how much are you going to hedge and, you know, go up or go down a little bit. So what that means is it turns out that over time, if a number of studies have been done in professional angel portfolios, which show that the typical return for a professionally managed angel portfolio is 25% annually, 25% IRR, which is pretty amazing when you compare that to, you know, the 1% you can get in the bank these days, or maybe over time 5% plus or minus from the stock market, or maybe 10% from a hedge fund, or 15% from a venture capital fund. 25% IRR is an enormous return, but it comes with enormous illiquidity and a long-term holding period. The average time that this money is illiquid because it's going into these companies in the U.S. is 7 to 9 years, so you can't get your money out next week if you want to buy a house or send your kid to college. It goes in and it stays in. And not only does it stay in, but since half the companies you invest in are going to fail, if you invest in 10 companies, divide your money up, invest in 10 companies, five of them are going to fail. You know, two of them are going to maybe if you're lucky, return your original cash in. Two others will be modest successes. And that means that last one company had better darn well be a knockout home run success, which will ultimately make the whole portfolio generate that 25% IRR. And what that means is, although you would hopefully target a 25% IRR across your whole portfolio, each individual company in which you invest, you have to be able to see a way to ultimately make 30 times your money, 30x over a period of 5, 6, 7 years.
So diversification is a huge part of this. You can't just go in and make one deal.
Absolutely not. In the book, I suggested, 20 deals or so is a minimum, 20 to 30. In my own case, I've got investments in over 90 companies for well over a decade, and that probably is a lot more than you need. But if you are not prepared to do this seriously and deliberately and invest over some period of time, a few years, into at least, say, 20 companies, and probably more than that would be even better, the odds are not going to be in your favor, because nobody can predict how any one particular company is going to do. We invest at such an early stage when it's so risky that even if you have the best idea in the best market with the best entrepreneur, things can and will go wrong. So you can't put all your money on one horse. What you have to do is you have to be the owner of the racetrack. You got to buy the entire field and get your piece of it. And if you do that, then the odds are very good that you will have a decent return.
And what are you actually buying? What do you get in return for your cash infusion? And what form does that take?
The way you get your return is you buy equity, which is ownership in the company itself. So you are a partner in the company. You are a part owner of the company, and you buy it when the company is very young and therefore is not valued very highly. And you hold on to it for a long period of time until the company hopefully takes that money, uses it to grow and expand and develop its product and its reach and becomes a very big and successful company. And then ultimately, after 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, in rare cases, goes public and becomes a mega company, and that happens once in a lifetime or so if you're lucky. But much more typically, the company will be acquired, if it's successful, by a larger company. And the typical company in the U.S. is acquired for $30, $40 million, $50 million. And so if when you invest in a company, when you buy shares of stock in a company, the company is worth, say, $3 million. And when the company is sold, the whole company is purchased, assuming it took in no more money, for $30 million, that means the value of the ownership piece in that company has gone up 10 times, so you get 10 times your money.
But equity can take multiple forms. Are you looking for common stock, preferred, convertibles? Do you ever go the route of accepting debt?
Oh, that's a very good question. And the answer is, in terms of straight debt, loaning money to a company, no. And it's for the same reason that banks do not loan money to startup companies, because, as we said, startup companies are very, very risky, and banks are not in the risk business. They're in the renting money business and getting a return. And so, therefore, if you as an angel investor were to take the risk of lending a startup company money, and then they go off and make $1 billion and come back, in 2 years, 5 years, whatever, and return the cash you put in plus, say, 5% interest, you'd be taking an enormous amount of risk and getting a very, very small return. So angels typically do not go in for straight debt. What they might go into is something called convertible debt, which starts out as a note but gets to convert at their option into equity in the company, typically after it's gotten a little bit of traction. But the terms of that investment have to specify at how much what the valuation of the company will be to invest in. And so, therefore, typically angels invest in what is called convertible preferred stock. And that means you're trying to cover your downside as well as your upside. As you and your listeners probably know, preferred stock comes out first if the company is sold or winds up. The first cash goes to pay off the preferred stock, but it comes out one for one. The dollar you put in, you get back a dollar. And so the stuff that angels buy starts out as that. And so in a bad case, if the company gets into trouble and sells for less than you thought it was worth initially, that preferred stock that you're holding comes out one for one. You get your money back. But the convertible part means that if a good thing happens and it's now worth a whole lot more and somebody, a larger company, buys it at an increase, then you can choose to convert your preferred stock into, at that point in the future, common stock, and therefore get the benefit of the big equity uptick.
We have lots to cover with David Rose. We're talking about the new book, Angel Investing, The Gust Guide to Making Money and Having Fun Investing in Startups, written with the idea for the angel investor, but I think it also serves well for those who are looking for capitalization from angel investors as well. Angel Investing by David S. Rose. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. Money Radio, thanks so much for joining us today. We're talking with David S. Rose, author of the new book, Angel Investing, The Gust Guide to Making Money and Having Fun Investing in Startups. We need to get to that. What is Gust? Gust.com.
Gust.com is a company that I started a number of years ago after my experience as a startup entrepreneur, having founded several companies, as an angel investor, having invested in a lot of companies, and as the founder of an angel group of lots of angel investors here in New York. It turned out that as angel investing was getting more and more professional and more widespread, there were no tools to do this right. It was almost like people running around in a dark football field in the middle of the night wearing sunglasses saying, I want to find a startup company, while the startups were saying, I want to find an investor. And so we created Gust is a platform that is used by both startup companies and angel investors in order to help find each other and help get to the terms of a deal. So it's used by startup companies to manage their investors and their investor relations. It's used by investors to find and look at startups. It's used by groups of angel investors to collaborate with each other on investing in companies. So it's sort of the universal underlying platform for this whole field of angel investing.
Angel investing, I think, is about to change, and part of that goes to the Jobs Act of 2012, which is not yet fully implemented. We've seen Title II take place, which allows solicitation of accredited investors, but we're still talking about accredited investors. That's scheduled to change, I think, within the next couple of months, perhaps, to Title III, which opens it up to a whole bunch of people. What does this mean for the realm of angel investing?
Well, you got it exactly right. Title III of the Jobs Act 2012 will let people who are not accredited investors for the first time buy equity in startup companies without a company being public. Well, that's really important because it will admit a whole lot more people into the realms of being able to invest in startups. I think that actually Title II will actually be the bigger thing because, as you noted, Title II for the first time allows companies to say they are raising money. Before September 23rd of last year, a company could raise money from accredited investors, that's people with over $1 million in assets or over $200,000 in income, but they couldn't tell anybody they were raising money. So you sort of had to know somebody who had that kind of money and who would give it to you without you publicly saying, hey, I'd like to raise money. That changed with the Jobs Act. So Title II says you can now say far and wide, hey, we're raising money, come invest in my company, provided that the only people you allow to actually invest are accredited investors. And that has enabled platforms now like Gust and a number of other online platforms to let companies post their offerings online and say, hey, reach a wide audience. Say, if you think this is interesting, come and let's talk about an investment. Title III, which for the first time will open up a limited form of investing to people who are not accredited investors, the goal was a way to open up investing in startups and the attendant, you know, potential high returns you could get, while at the same time protecting people who are not quite as sophisticated investors as the standard assumes that accredited or qualified investors are. And so therefore, to handle the protection piece of it, they have put in enormous amounts of rules and regulations that will govern how this will work. The draft rules for Title III are about 212 pages of documentation about the kinds of internet funding platforms, what companies need to do. And indeed, they at this point provide such a sort of hamstringing of the operation that many people think that it's not really workable as it is now, although the intention is really great, and eventually we will certainly get to something that will allow regular people to invest at least moderate amounts of money into startup companies.
But don't confuse angel investing with crowdfunding.
No, there's a very big difference. Crowdfunding, as people currently think about it, things like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, you're not getting equity in a company. You're not buying an ownership in a company. You're instead either pre-purchasing a product or making a contribution and getting an award.
And that may be nice, but it's not the ideal portfolio setup. David, we're out of time. I have many more questions. You have many answers in the book, Angel Investing, written for the angel investor, but also, I think, for entrepreneurs and understanding how angel investing really works. Some great information in there, including what makes a great pitch, and you even did a TED Talk on that that had some really great information. Angel Investing, The Gust Guide to Making Money and Having Fun Investing in Startups, Gust.com, G-U-S-T, as in a gust of wind, Gust.com. Our guest today, David S. Rose. David, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sinclair.